Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All right, so this from our website, posted by Pablo in the Bronx at 8:36 this morning. What's up with the SUV-sized strollers and toting enough gear for an Arctic expedition when going to the park? Sleeping coaches, wipe warmers? And so we begin our conversation with Pamela Paul. You know, if our economy had an extra $45 billion to throw around, how should we spend it? Feeding the children of families living in poverty? Or how about Louis Vuitton diaper bags? Yes, thanks to an affluent sampling of enthusiastic parents, the upscale baby market is worth billions now. And our next guest, Pamela Paul, thinks that most of these products don't do our kids any good. They may do them harm. She's the author of a new book called Parenting Inc., How We Are Sold on $800 Strollers, Fetal Education, Baby Sign Language, Sleeping Coaches, Toddler Couture, and diaper wipe warmers, and what it means for our children. Pamela, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So this phrase that I guess our listener picked up maybe from your blurb, sleeping coaches, what is that?
You know, that's actually not one of the bad ones, even though it sounds pretty horrifying. These are people who you can hire to help you get your child to sleep. And it sounds outrageous on the face of it. I was all ready to mock it when I started researching my book. I thought, here are, you know, the latest, you know, people taking advantage of parents' anxieties and vulnerabilities and, you know, can't parents just raise their kids themselves? The fact is, most of these sleeping coaches are women who are not charging a lot of money. They're often people who come from the helping professions. There are nurses, social workers, former teachers who found that they had a knack for getting their own babies to sleep and helped their friends and family, and then ended up doing for so many people that they finally realized, wait a minute, you know, I have to pay my own bills. I've got to charge people for this in order to make it worth my while. And they actually can help you get a child to go to sleep. Now, personally, I think it's a lot more worthwhile to spend, say, $400 and you get hours of this person's time on an hourly basis. They're not making a lot of money to get your child to sleep, rather than spending $3,000 on a fancy crib that the kid's going to be screaming their head off. You know, particularly if you're a working mom and you've got a 3-month-old who's waking up 3 times a night and you got to get back to the office.
When my kids were really little, I learned what the expression sleeping like a baby really means. It means you wake up screaming and kicking every 2 hours.
Right, right. So, you know, I got to say that one I think is kind of priceless. And that's one where I think that, that's a new development in the parenting market that I actually think is not so bad.
But your big message is that parenthood is too commercialized.
Absolutely. There's so much out there that is a complete waste of time, a complete waste of money. And parents really don't have, most parents don't have the money to spare because raising kids today costs a fortune.
What were some of the products that maybe tempted you as a new mother and maybe even inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, I think that like so many parents, you know, when I was pregnant with my first child, I had no idea what I was getting into. And you go into a Buy-Buy Baby or Babies R Us in the city, and they hand you this like huge packet of materials with lists of what you're supposed to register for. It's fascinating because, you know, 15 years ago, there was no such thing as a baby registry. Today, American women have on average 3 baby showers with multiple registries. And I just thought to myself, wait a minute, you know, my mom didn't have any of this stuff. How is it possible that, you know, that we need all this stuff that kids somehow got by, parents got by without just a generation ago? Are we any better for it? You know, what's really necessary here?
So here's a post on our website that says, being a recent auntie of 2 baby nieces, I thoroughly enjoy going up and down the aisles in Babies R Us and exclaiming, that's so cute, when I see another baby in an adorable outfit. Luckily, I have impulse control not to buy everything I see on TV commercials. Is part of your point that too many parents don't have enough impulse control and there are really negative effects from this?
Well, you know, I think that parents are a vulnerable market, and marketers know this. Everyone wants to do the best for their child, and we live in an intensely consumer society, and we now have this crazy parenting consumer culture. And when, you know, what that has turned into is if you want the best for your child, then you're willing to buy the best for your child. You're willing to do everything you can. And that has turned into something I call the anxiety of underspending. There's this fear that if I don't get this for my child, and everybody else, say, is enrolling their child in baby sign language classes, or everyone else has the, you know, the special chair that, you know, helps a three-month-old sit up before they're sitting up on their own, that somehow all the other kids are going to be advanced and my child is going to fall behind. And so we're a vulnerable target. You know, we all want to do the best for our children.
And your remark on the huge rate of increase in baby spending versus income. Are families actually going into debt to keep up with baby trends?
Yeah, and it's not just trends. You know, it's interesting. I live up in Harlem, and up in Harlem, we have a huge proliferation of tutoring services for toddlers. And it's, you know, people think that tutoring is for upscale, you know, upper middle class people in Westchester and, you know, wealthy suburbs who want to get their kid into the Ivy League. And that's not the full story. You know, many of these tutoring services are targeted towards working parents who look at the economy and see how tough it is and how much they've had to struggle, and they want to be sure that their child is equipped with everything possible to make sure their kids don't fall behind. Now, unfortunately, what's being sold at these tutoring services from a pedagogical point of view is really not very good for toddlers.
Like what?
Well, they are focused on rote memorization of numbers and letters. They don't have a multisensory approach to how they teach. I mean, basically, you ask any early childhood educator to go in there and evaluate what they're doing, and they will tell you it's absolutely wrong. And not only that, but there's no reason for a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old to have to be learning their letters and numbers at that age. You know, there have been multiple studies that show that the earlier you learn to read, not necessarily the better. In Scandinavia, for example, in Norway, the children don't learn to read until they're 7 years old, and yet they have a much higher literacy rate than we do.
Is there harm in it, though? I mean, you know, because at the same time, we hear that because of the education gap that still exists in this country between rich and poor, between black and white, that programs like Head Start, which are for preschoolers, obviously, are vital. And so that you got to get kids immersed in letters. You got to get kids immersed in numbers at that age.
Well, that's for 4-year-olds, primarily Head Start, you know, 3 and mostly 4-year-olds. And there's plenty of research showing that education at that point is very important. But when you're talking about a 2 or, you know, a young 3-year-old being in an after-school tutoring program where the approach is wrong, you also have to look at the opportunity cost. What are the kids not doing during that time? And what is lost is outdoor play, socialization, unstructured playtime, all the things that, you know, educators tell us are more important for children to learn. You know, the great thing about all this is the best way for your children to learn, the best ways are actually the least expensive. You know, it's throwing a bunch of kids in a room together and with blocks. And that's fine. You don't need fancy electronic toys. You don't need a structured tutoring program or a baby class.
So let's get some parents in on this conversation. Are you pushing around a Bugaboo stroller or popping Baby Einstein videos into the DVD player when you're only 4 months pregnant? Or have you resisted the temptation to overspend? Oh, our lines are full. I think you've touched a chord here. Pamela Paul, author of Parenting, Inc., How We Are Sold on $800 Strollers, Fetal Education, Baby Sign Language, Sleeping Coaches, Toddler Couture and Diaper Wipe Warmers, and What It Means to Our Children. Peg in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peg.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on a strange thing I've observed. I was the products editor at Child Magazine for many years and also trained to be a car seat technician and work for the NTSB at NHTSA. And basically, I went into women's homes for about a year, and I took a tally of what they were spending their money on. And we're talking about, you know, this is, you know, $500,000 on bedding, all kinds of crazy things. And I did notice that really we are scared into spending money and thinking the more I spend, the safer my child will be. But the one area that doesn't hold was that I would finish up this huge list and I'd say, where's your car seat? And they would say, oh, you know, I'm borrowing that from my sister-in-law, or I'm going to get it at a garage sale. And I think to myself, if we're so worried about safety, the one unglamorous item that nobody spends even a minute thinking about. I mean, sometimes the bride tag seats are now becoming popular, but people are borrowing them and not buying them. And it's the one item that probably you should be spending money on. So it's this strange split in our value system, and I'm not sure of why. We care less about something so obvious and unglamorous, and we spend $1,000 on bedding or on the fancy juvenile product.
Pamela, do you agree?
Well, you know, halfway. I think that actually, you know, maybe people have caught up since then, because now there is, the car seat sales are booming. And, you know, especially in New York, it's interesting that, you know, with so many parents who don't even own cars, how many parents are out there spending, you know, the top of the line Britex roundabout marathon car seats.
And what do they do? Take them into taxis with them?
No, nobody does that, which is interesting. You have parents who won't go in taxis with young children because they don't want to have to lug the car seat. I mean, there are a bunch of, I would say, very New York-specific dilemmas with the parenting market because we take so much public transportation and taxis opposed to driving around. Strollers are another issue where what we buy doesn't necessarily make sense in terms of how we travel. But I do agree with you about the safety, which I think, and I do think that I agree with you that we have a warped perception of what is actually risky and dangerous for children and what is safe. And you go into any baby store and there's the wall of death that's equipped with, you know, hundreds of little plastic gewgaws that you're supposed to affix to every surface of your house. Somehow, most kids did not fall into the toilet and drown without a special, you know, clasp holding the toilet seat shut. A clasp which I may add, I would say about 9 out of 10 parents find impossible to open themselves.
Peg,
The other thing that's really interesting is that I don't know if you've been to the Juvenile Products Manufacturing Show, which is basically a huge circus of every product that people are bringing to market and are hoping to get to retailers. But the really fascinating thing about juvenile products is that you think that if it's for sale at Toys R Us or at Babies R Us, it's safe. And basically, it is voluntary to get things to self-test and then get a nod from Juvenile Products Manufacturer Association. It is not required in order to get to market. And the only thing, even car seats, they have to be self-tested again, and not until you have a window of 1 year while it's on the market, once it's on the shelf.
You mean self-testing as opposed to independent testing of these products?
Yeah, there's no independent testing required.
Peg, thank you very much. Important call. All right. When we continue in a minute with Pamela Paul, Pamela Paul, author of Parenting Inc., we're going to have a caller from Irvington who I think is going to be interesting because she already has two kids and she's pregnant again. And she says she can't believe the amount of change in parenting in just this short time. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Pamela Paul, author of Parenting Inc., How We Are Sold on $800 Strollers, Fetal Education, Baby Sign Language, Sleeping Coaches, Toddler Couture, and Diaper Wipe Warmers. And Sherry, is it Sherry or Cherry in Irvington? You're on WNYC. Hi there.
It's Sherry. Hi.
Hi.
So I'm 44, and I have a 17-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I'm unexpectedly expecting again, and I'm
congratulations.
And I thought, okay, it's been a long time, but, you know, I'm in this mode of, you know, everything's going to be simple. Baby, what could the baby possibly need? I'm paring down. And I spent 4th of July weekend with four women in their 30s, my cousins and two of their friends who are all either just having had babies or expecting their first. And I thought my head would explode by the end of the day because the amount of stuff and choices that are available and according to them, mandatory at this point. In the 12 years since I've been in this mode, I was quite overwhelmed. I'm looking at colleges for next year, and I thought I was going to be able to pare down, and it seems like there's that much more and that much more I'm going to need for my baby to be advantaged and safe and you know, on a par with all of his peers.
So with all your experience parenting, do you say to this stuff, wow, this is all so great, I can be such a better parent of a baby now than I could 17 years ago? Or do you say, oh, come on, give me a break. Who needs all this?
I feel both, actually. I feel much calmer than you know, my younger moms to be, and much more, you know, prepared emotionally and mentally. But at the same time, these are all intelligent women. They're all, you know, college-educated, bright young women telling me, but you need this, and you must have that. And needless to say, I have nothing because it's been 12 years. I have to get everything new. And the pressure to have so much more than I ever expected is quite overwhelming. And I, and needless to say, there was no internet for me 12 years ago, so the possibilities are endless in terms of shopping and options and choices. I would love to have things pared down for me, and I'm a little overwhelmed.
You know, it's amazing because a lot of people, when I talk about this book, they say, oh, but, you know, you have your first baby and then you're all set because you know that, you know, so much of it is nonsense. And, you know, not at all true, as your case points out. And in fact, I had a second child when I was writing this book, and I still ended up buying things that turned out to be completely unnecessary because it's really easy. We're really easily suckered in by this. You know, we parents, the marketers take care of go after every flash of insecurity and guilt and fear and worry. You know, perhaps you're working now full time and you weren't before, or you're at home now full time and you weren't before, and you feel like there are all kinds of new things that are necessary. It's remarkable. You know, somehow our parents got by without bouncy seats, jumperoos, extra saucers, things that may have not been around or in such great variety when your, you know, last child, your second child was a baby, and now they're there. And again, it's educated people who think of themselves as savvy consumers who nonetheless get trapped in by this. And it's so much easier to rationalize because, you know, oh, it's not for me. It's for my baby. And again, that peer pressure that you mentioned is very intense because if all the other kids are having, you know, if all of the other kids have a Stimmobile that's supposed to enhance early vision, you know, with these black and white patterns over the crib, and your baby doesn't, then you can't help but have 5% of you wondering, what if all these other children are going to be that much smarter and more visually aware, and my child isn't, just because I cheaped out on the Stimmobile?
Sherry, thanks for your call, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Now, comment 42 on our webpage for this from Wendy in Brooklyn says, an aside, because I was always listening to WNYC at home, my older daughter had Brian Lehrer speaking during her morning naps. She began talking at 7 months and just recently scored through the roof on the verbal portion of the SAT. Who needs baby classes? Pamela, should I feel guilty about this?
No, you know, I mean, it's amazing. I think that what's great about children really is that each child is like an N of one and there's no control. So you don't have like your baby who listened to the Brian Lehrer and then your, you know, clone of the baby who didn't, and you can't then test them. So there's so many products out there that allegedly, you know, enhance this or that. And it might just be that that particular child was an early talker. One of my favorites is this fetal education baby plus. It's this thing, it looks like a fanny pack and you strap it around your baby, you know, your pregnant belly, and it makes these sort of thump, thump, thump noises like someone, you know, jogging, or, you know, and it has these different lessons, and supposedly the fetus learns to discriminate between the sound of the mom digesting her meatloaf or whatever and the noises of these lessons, and then will come out in the end being a better nurser, an earlier talker, have a higher IQ point. And where's the proof? Because you obviously can't compare it with the baby who didn't have baby plus and to see how they're faring.
Well, I want to see the separated at birth twins, one of whom was raised listening to this show, the other listening to Sean Hannity. There's a psychological experiment.
Now, well, that one, you know what? That one you probably could prove, because one thing that is true is that the more vocabulary words a child is exposed to, their language skills will be when they're older. And the greatest thing is that's all free.
You have a sort of worst of list, right?
Mm-hmm.
Give me some.
I have my own pet peeves, and I think, you know, any mom out there trying to empty out their closets sure has their own. Some of the ones I think are the worst. One of my favorites is the Time's Up, Time's Out teddy bear. And this is a teddy bear that has a timer on its belly. And the idea is when your child is in timeout and they're kicking and screaming and they don't want to sit in the corner, you give them the Time's Up teddy bear, and they have a nice little teddy they can cuddle during it, and they have a little timer that they can watch going tick, 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 and they know that as soon as the little, you know, clock ticks around, Time's Out's going to be over. So isn't that nice? The problem with this is Time Out is supposed to be punishment. It's supposed to be awful. It's not supposed to be fun with a cuddly little teddy bear saying, it's okay, it's almost done. That's not the purpose of it. So I think what we end up doing with so many products is sort of smiley facing out the necessarily dark parts of a child's life. And, you know, human existence is full of dark, frustrating, annoying, painful, dangerous moments. And children have to learn that.
Yeah, you'd be one of those people who take cable TV out of prisons, wouldn't you? baby sign language. This is in the subtitle of your book. What is baby sign language?
You know, it's one of these things that sounds totally ludicrous to non-parents, but any parent who hears it is like, oh, of course, baby sign language. My child took it. They're so much smarter. Baby sign language is a variation of American Sign Language that is taught to babies. There's really no standardization. There are a huge number of DVDs. There's Baby Sign Language for Dummies or the Idiot's Guide. There are classes all over the city and over the country that teach children how to sign before they can talk. And the idea is this. Your baby is frustrated because when he says, what he's trying to say is, I want more, but you think he's saying, I'm bored, take me out of the high chair. And so now your baby will learn a sign that will say, I want more, as opposed to pick me up, I want to get out. Well, this all sounds great. Oh, eliminate frustration. And also, the baby sign language industry will tell you, your children will be smarter by an average of 12 IQ points by the time they're 8 years old. The reality is, when you look at all this research, it doesn't stand up. And a number of educators will say to you, well, you know, first of all, what could your child be doing while you're teaching them to sign, you know, to sign? There are things that children are learning that they can't tell us about that seem to us very obvious, like when you put a cup down on the table, it sits there and doesn't sink through and fall to the floor. And they're busy learning that quietly, and instead we're trying to distract them by teaching them baby sign language.
In the book, you describe an insecure moment while playing with your daughter Beatrice, when you felt like you just weren't doing enough, and a friend advised you to just give her some time lying around staring at whatever. This staring time, that's another concept.
Yeah, well, it's really important. I think that we are told that we need to stimulate your child. And parents, you know, especially if you're working, you feel like, okay, I've got this amount of time with my child. I want to maximize it and optimize it and do everything I can. So this is a really great moment where they're learning. And I think, you know, a lot of parents understandably have anxiety that, okay, when they're not with me, they're in daycare or they're with the nanny and I don't know what's going on. So I want to really have this time be, you know, special and you know, doing everything it possibly can for my child. The truth is, the world is stimulating enough. There isn't extra stimulation that children need. A child can stare at a ceiling fan for 15 minutes, and that's, you know, incredibly beneficial. They don't need you to be waving a toy in front of their face.
Have you ever, did you look into France at all in comparison to the United States? Because one of the things that I gather about France, one of the reasons they have all this universal preschool and early, even, you know, infancy daycare there, is not just to free up the parents to go to work, but also because that nation tends to believe that parents are amateurs, well-meaning and, you know, loving of their children as they are, and the daycare centers have professionals who really actually know better what to do in many cases.
Yeah, and in some ways they do know better, in some ways they don't necessarily. I mean, you know, I love France. I used to live there, and I think
you did.
And I think that, you know, the low cost and free daycare and early education is fantastic, and I would take that, you know, almost no matter what the daycare workers were doing with the children. But you know, I think that in this country we are starting to professionalize parenting in the same way, and to turn it into something that you need to have special equipment, special expertise, you need to have read all of these books, you need all of these products and services in order to make sure that you're doing it right. And I always try to, you know, call up in my memory the idea of, you know, Ben Franklin. You know, he grew up to be a scientist, a diplomat, an author, a politician, you know, so many things that any parent would be very content if their child just achieved, you know, 1/50th of what he did. And he didn't even have a teddy bear because they weren't invented yet. I don't think that his mother angsted over, you know, what kind of classes to enroll Ben Franklin in, and he did okay.
But some of this professionalization, you call it outsourcing of parenthood.
Yes, because there is this concept that if you can't do it yourself, then you need to hire someone else to do it. And, you know, you can go way overboard with that kind of thing, hiring someone to teach your child how to ride a bicycle, hiring tutoring services to teach your child how to know their alphabet by the time they're two, hiring people to help you, get potty train your child. And we certainly can go overboard. But I think that what has happened, what's at the core of this is that parents, I think, have been robbed of sort of a sense of their own competency. Parents are incredibly insecure, and the caller earlier who talked about how she sort of, despite having raised two children to the age of 17 and 12, she feels newly at a loss at the prospect of a third child. And I think that's a message that this whole sort of consumer parenting culture and professionalized parenting sends to parents, that you're not capable of doing it on your own.
Pamela Paul with me for just a few minutes more. She's the author of Parenting, Inc. And Marie in Bloomfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I'm actually in the IKEA parking lot in Paramus, New Jersey, specifically to get children's toys that are not mechanized, that don't require batteries. And I'm actually kind of running out of time because my son just woke up. But I have been doing my best to resist a great deal of the consumerism in this first 6 months of my son's life, and I actually have acquaintances and family members who feel bad for my son as if we were poor because I choose not to get him some things. And it appalls me, both because I think that people aren't up on reading and they're so consumerist and insecure in their own parenting skills that they need crutches that come with batteries.
What a story. Pamela Paul, social pressure.
I think that you can be confident. You know, I actually end my book on a similar note. You know, think about what you're doing for your child rather than what you're buying for your child.
What do they sell, like balsa wood toys in IKEA or something?
I'm sorry?
Do they sell wood toys in IKEA?
They do. They sell wooden toys. They sell things that have been approved by the European consumer inspectors, so that there's, for me, a great deal less risk of lead and other poisons. But yeah, they have very simple, boring, doesn't light up kind of toys, as well as some plush, but really great wood stuff that's a lot less expensive than at the European import stores in Montclair.
Marie, I hear your waking son. Good luck at IKEA.
Yes, there he is. Thank you.
Making his radio debut. Pamela, a last word.
I would say Maria makes a really good point, and that is toys that look boring, they're better. The best toys are 90% child, 10% toy. So the more open-ended and boring the toy looks, a ball, a teddy bear, plain wooden blocks, the more your child is going to put into it and get out of it.
Pamela Paul, author of Parenting, Inc., How We Are Sold on $800 Strollers, Fetal Education, Baby Sign Language, Sleeping Coaches, Toddler Couture, and Diaper Wipe Warmers, and What It Means for Our Children. Great discussion. You've obviously sparked a lot of reaction from the parents in the audience. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.